Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour. This is for May 26, 2022. And last week I ran right up to the end of the show and talking about this small paper, 1987 copyright, used in the American Geophysical Union meetings as a way of putting a completely neutral paper, in other words, not specifically talking about comets or solar systems or solar wind, but simply a paper talking about, and this could be in a laboratory, in a vacuum chamber, this could be in a outer space, this could be in a galaxy, this could be in a solar system, the star system, whatever. It simply deals with what happens when you have a non-uniform plasma, in other words, a charge distribution that is non-uniform, and an object comes into it. What happens? This is a very important paper because it tells you that the things that you see in outer space and that the tokens or the expressions or the side effects of this interaction of a neutral object coming in to a non-uniform plasma are detectable by spacecraft. And it talks about exactly what those detectables are and how to read them on the instrumentation on a satellite. And so I was reading the abstract when I just ran out of time last week, so I'll continue with that now. And I was at the point where I was talking about, and so I'll just continue reading where I left off last week with a little bit of overlap here. The plasma relaxation time, in other words, the time that it takes this plasma to neutralize, to move towards its neutral state, the plasma relaxation time in the presence of the passing object will be compared to that which would occur if the object were not present. This presents a complex but interesting class of plasma physics problem whose signatures are detectable by spacecraft instrumentation sometimes at great distances from the object, and whose principles can be demonstrated in the laboratory. Such plasma situations exist in many regions of the solar system. Solar flares are a primary example, in which the sun selectively ejects composite streamers of similarly charged particles. Flares' frequency produce effects far into the planetary regions. Other examples are the plasma belts around planets with significant magnetic fields, planetary bow shock regions, as well as plasma tails, regions of magnetic turbulence, and irregularities in the planetary ionospheres. Objects around which currents may be induced when passing through a non-uniform plasma may be small ring particles, moons or moonlets, asteroids, spacecraft, and possibly even planets. A major result shows that although the object begins with a net charge of zero, it quickly charges to a net negative value, creating detectable effects at great distances from the object in the form of plus ion sheaths, plasma tails, and associated electric and magnetic field effects. Okay, so that's the introduction. That's the abstract. And so, like I say, this paper is quite long. It's in the appendix of the Atlantis to Tesla, the Goldwyn Connection book. But the importance of this paper is, I just cannot really overestimate the actual importance of this paper. And I would put this on the list, actually very high on the list of Nobel Prize quality papers. Because when you compare it to, say, something like the photoelectric effect that Einstein won a Nobel Prize for that, or the paper that won a Nobel Prize dealing with fusion, the fusion chains building up atoms, etc., in the solar furnace would be another. Or like the Bohr atom paper, which came a year after Einstein's, or many other, say, the Curie papers that won Nobel Prizes because of their key importance and the general nature that one of those things, it just was the key that opened the lock that nobody understood. That in, you have to understand in this time frame, the 1985-87 time frame, that this paper was put out and then copyrighted, etc., and used at the American Geophysical Union meeting, everybody believed that space had to be electrically neutral. So it was not something on the drawing board. It was not something anybody even considered. And I knew that this was the key to understanding all of these different phenomena that you see, not the least of which was how planets form. And so anyway, I'll be talking a little bit about this paper. I'll be picking out key parts of it. But I want to repeat something. Now, I've talked about this before. And let me talk to people who are trained physicists, electrical engineers, and people who have experience, literally experience building electrical entities. Let's call them, like, say, motors or generators or other electrical devices. And you understand Maxwell's equations, the relationship between electric and magnetic fields, and how magnetic fields can generate electricity given a power source, etc. Everything you know about the interpretation of Maxwell's equations in the design of physical things, everything you know does not apply to plasma physics. Plasma physics is an entirely different way of viewing things. And I give the example, a very simple example, the magnetic field of the Earth. Geologists don't know where the magnetic field come from, so they could talk about a dynamo. A dynamo is a physical process that occurs when you take, like, say, let's take a simple example, a hand crank on a shaft, and on that shaft are mounted magnets, permanent magnets, and you rotate that, you turn the hand crank, and then outside of that you have windings that are metal windings, metal wire, copper typically, or aluminum, and the magnetic fields, as it moves, because you're cranking this crank and moving the rotor, the magnetic fields are crossing the wires in the windings, and it causes current to flow in the windings, and therefore you can create electrical power. You can transfer that mechanical power to electrical energy, and then you can transform it, and that's the basis of the Tesla transformers, etc. None of that applies to plasma physics. Plasma physics does not work that way. So when you see scientists, for example, trying to understand the and they get it, they always get it backwards, completely backwards. Like the electrical current that flows between Io, the moon, innermost moon of Jupiter, and the planet Jupiter, they go, "Oh, that's because Io is moving in the magnetic field of Jupiter and it creates this current, like a dynamo." Wrong. Absolutely wrong. It's completely backwards. What's going on there is Jupiter has a excess current of protons in its wind coming off because it's a fusion-based object. It creates a capacitor. Io is discharging that capacitor, and you see the current sheets as a result of that discharge. And then the magnetic field that results on Jupiter, which is a plasma magnetic field, is a result of that electrical discharge. So they have it backwards, completely 100%, 180 degrees backwards. The same with planet Earth. Earth's magnetic field is driven by the moon's interaction with Earth and the electrical nature of the moon. And so this sets up a current that is a plasma current. It's not a current like a dynamo, okay? And so, and I've also talked about the Earth's permanent magnetic field that is locked in iron and nickel, primarily in the surface mantle of the Earth, that there had to have been an external magnetic field as these, over millions of years, cooled down through the Curie temperature. And at least hundreds of thousands of years, there had to have been a permanent magnet of some type that gave the north direction, what we see north now. And And as those metals cool down and lock that magnetic field in the metals. And so there again, well, where did that external magnetic field come from? It's a plasma magnetic field, and plasma magnetic fields just don't magically, happily exist in outer space. And that was the problem with Hans Alfvén. His magnetohydrodynamics, it satisfied scientists at the time because they didn't have to have any mechanism that created the magnetic field. They were just magically there. And it's wrong. That's completely wrong. And so it's very important to understand that the physics of the transformations, the Maxwellian transformations of electric and B fields, magnetic fields, works totally different in outer space because the currents are not locked into wires. The electrons cannot get out of the wire. And so therefore, that puts a sideways force. The electrons in that magnetic field that's changing puts a sideways force on the wire, and it's the wire that carries the force that then transfers the mechanical energy into electrical energy that gives you electrical power. So now let's go out into outer space, and Chapman physics would tell you that plasma in outer space is by its very nature neutral, that it's equalized and there is no such thing as a non-uniform plasma. And this is what I'm saying, because you can see the effects of this. The moons of Saturn, the sweeper moons, the charged particles. Let me give you another example. This is another example. I was at an American Geophysical Union meeting, sitting there minding my own business, and there's some NASA scientists next to me talking. And they put out a barium tracer to see what would happen to barium. Now, these are barium particles, not barium atoms. So it's not at the molecular level or atomic level. It's at sand level, little particles of barium, probably particles the size of sand. And they put it out there, and they observed it with a satellite. And they became charged, and they formed little comet tails. And they couldn't figure out what was going on. Well, they were in a non-uniform plasma, and where did the non-uniform plasma come from? Well, the satellite itself was creating that, was discharging the local electric field and charging up, and then there was the non-uniform electric field of the satellite itself, which was they were observing because of the interaction of barium, and it had nothing. It could have been silicate sand, and it would have done the same thing. But they had barium, and they couldn't figure out what was going on. So anyway, that's another example. So the fact that I came out and said, look, there are these non-uniform plasma situations, and I don't necessarily talk about how they got there. If you go up to my weather book, which was published in the 2000s, it was after my Planet X Comets and Earth Changes book, after the Surviving Planet X Passage pamphlet, and after Atlantis to Tesla was the third book for the popularization of my work back in the early 2000s. And then came the weather book. And it was in that book I defined LEBs, local electrical batteries. Now, these are plasma batteries that form around planet Earth, and which can be used in the discharge of these for various processes. I'll just say that. And so anyway, where do these come from? So I'm going to give you an example here of how because of the sun's fusion, because it's spitting out protons and electrons in the solar wind, what happens when that stream of electrons and protons comes up and meets the magnetic field of Earth. Well, the electrons go one way, they're diverted one way, and the protons go the other way. Well, what's that doing? It's creating a battery. You're creating a battery because of the interaction of the solar wind with the plasma magnetic field that surrounds Earth. Earth's magnetic field is five layers, and I also define that. It's a five-layered plasma magnetic field, and the very smallest component of this is the permanent magnet, which is in the mantle and crust of the Earth due to iron and nickel, permanent magnets. But the five layers, one includes the ionosphere, which has counter-rotating current belts. One is the you could include the jet streams, which are ionized moving current streams in the coupled with the magnetic field. The Van Allen belts are another coupling of electrical charge moving in these belts that are surround planet Earth. And then the overall larger magnetic field, which surrounds Earth. It's outside of the Van Allen belt, and that ends at around 35,000 miles to the sunward side of Earth, and then it stretches way out behind Earth, and plasma physicists and space scientists misname that. It's a misnomer. They call it the magnetic tail. Well, it looks like a magnetic tail, but it's really the result of the electrical discharge that Earth is undergoing in the non-uniform electric field of the sun. And so you see this. Now, I'm just going to say this word non-uniform. Non-uniform electric fields, non-uniform plasmas, non-uniform. In other words, the majority of effects that we see for our weather on Earth or the weather on Jupiter or Saturn or upper wind systems at Venus, etc., are the direct result of the Earth or Jupiter discharging the solar capacitor. And these are plasma effects. And if it were not for that non-uniform electric field, we wouldn't have weather at all. We wouldn't have wind. We would not have clouds. We would not have tornadoes. We wouldn't have lightning storms. No clouds, nothing. And so it's very, once again, back to this paper that talks about the discharges caused by foreign objects entering non-uniform plasmas. So hopefully you get the flavor, at least if you're not a physicist, you get the flavor of what's going on here. If you're a physicist, or if you're even more than that, more so involved with outer space, then these are things that are fundamental to understanding what's going on. If you're Elon Musk and you're running a space program and you want to go to the moon, you better understand these things, and your physicists that you're working with now don't. They don't understand the issues involved with radiation. If you're talking about going to Mars, building a spaceship is the least of your problems. That's mechanical. That's something anybody can build with given enough good engineering, which he has, given enough planning, getting the right amount of food, getting everything else. But the one thing they're missing is understanding the interaction of this spacecraft with the plasma environment, which gives you severe radiation. He doesn't have that on his docket. So anyway, what I'm going to do now is go through this paper and discuss point by point. First of all, I want to mention also, this is an esoteric thing that came out of the same time frame, and I'll be talking about the spacecraft that went to Halley's Comet. But before I forget it, I want to mention this specifically, that a group of scientists, astronomers, went to South America when Halley's Comet was coming through the solar system in the mid-1980s. They took spectrographic equipment, spectrometers, to South America, and they were going to take the spectrum of Halley's Comet, the tail, the other. And what they saw was a redshift coming off of the nucleus. And so they're like, there should not be a redshift. The only redshift knowns were due to motion, object moving away from you, and that would produce a redshift. That's the special relativistic redshift. Well, the comet was not moving away at the time. It was actually moving towards them, and it's still producing a redshift. And then the only other one might be due to general relativity, due to light being, these are the standard theories that I'm talking about. General relativity implying that the comet nucleus would be this massive black hole type of object causing a redshift. And certainly a comet is this, you know, in their minds, this fluffy little snowball with no mass at all. So it certainly couldn't be due to, it could not be due to the general relativistic redshift. So what was it? There, to them, there is no other redshift. Well, what it is based on the induced electric dipole redshift. If the comet nucleus charging and non-uniform electric field and causing redshifts, but of course, they didn't know what to do, so they trashed the data. They threw it away, swept it under the rug. Doesn't fit the theory, doesn't fit the MIME, so throw it away. That's what they did. Once again, just corruption in science. What they should have done is published it as an unsolved mystery. That's what should have happened. But that's not what scientists do, because they don't want to admit that they don't know something. So they have to make a proposal that somehow fits the narrative. What I'm going to do now is read some passages here from the paper. And just to give you a flavor, because like I say, this is a very long paper, and just to give you a flavor of what's going on here, I have some figures in the paper. And so the first figure is of a NP, a positive, negative plasma with nothing there. There's no object. And first, a little bit of discussion. Figure 2 shows a fully developed discharge between N and P regions, boundary layer. In other words, if you took an average, a spatial average of the charge in these plasmas, which are where the plus and the negative charges are separated, and I don't talk about how they got to that position. That's there again. That's another theoretical issue on how the sun works and these fusion and the separation of charge, etc. So I don't go into that in this paper. I'm just talking about what happens and what are the visual effects. This is a non-uniform plasma with no objects. And so the figure 1 is this charge distribution with no objects. So it says in the paper, charge distribution, electric potentials in general are continuous and well-behaved functions. Due to their higher mobility, electrons are the primary charge carriers in the relaxation process. So relaxation was these two plasma nodes, positive and negative, start to merge and then basically neutralize each other. And remember that an electron in this sea of other electrons and positively charged ions, etc., does not see any net charge in any given direction. There's just this imbalance of the non-uniform electric field. So it sees there's a mild force that is experienced by the electron. It's not as what you would call it's different than if you had a single positive ion there and a single electron with nothing else around. The electron would be attracted very strongly to the ion to try and neutralize the ion and bring it to a neutral state. But in a plasma, that's not the case. The electron does not see that big field. It sees kind of a very broadened field. It's not a point source, etc. So very important to understand. And once again, this is very different than if it's in a wire or a physical circuit. So due to higher mobility, the electrons are the primary charge carriers. And that's something I discovered also, which is very important in these processes, is the charge to mass ratio. And so you have the positively charged ions are probably tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of times more massive than the electrons. So the electrons constitute the primary charge movement in the relaxation of the plasma. And so bulk movement of the distribution relative to each other would follow the same ratios as the plasma is relaxed and the non-uniform charge distribution becomes neutralized. The rate of relaxation is reduced exponentially. So the more this plasma becomes neutralized, the slower the process of neutralization becomes. And it continues almost infinitely but it gets to the point where it's almost completely neutralized. The time for the total electric potential U to relax to one-half its original value is called a relaxation time, or half-life. And this is just a normal non-uniform plasma without an object. It's very slow. It's a very slow process. Okay, now what happens if we introduce an object in there? Now, the object is not charged. It's just an object. It's coming in from outer space, out of nowhere. And this is very important, too, and it's one of the big errors made by Chapman physics, is they put a charge out in space, and they didn't tell you how it got there. How did a charged particle or charged mass end up in the middle of this plasma? They don't tell you that. It's just it's a physics problem. It's a Gedanken problem. It's a thought problem. And so it's very important. How did this object get to where it is? And so anyway, in the real situation, in this example, the object coming in might be a comet nucleus, might be moon of Saturn. It comes in uncharged. It's neutral. And so the charging process occurs after it moves into the non-uniform plasma. And this is the crux of the issue. Because if you have a non-uniform plasma source, like the sun, separating charge, the excess current of protons in the solar wind, you have an ongoing source of energy, and that's what powers our ionosphere to ground, that's what powers our weather, that's what Tesla was tapping into, that's what Tesla knew was there, but he didn't know what caused it. Okay, so now let's bring an object in to this non-uniform plasma, the same one we had before that relaxed, but this time we're going to bring an object in. What happens? Okay, so out of the paper it says, if a foreign object passes through a non-uniform plasma, depending on many factors, it may greatly alter the normal plasma relaxation process. The threshold for causing a significant effect is quite low due to the essentially infinite conductivity of the plasma. Very important to understand also. In a wire, you have resistivity. In outer space, the charges are free to move. There's nothing holding them back. There's no resistance. Okay, reading on. A general principle can be stated. The initial ability of an object to affect the relaxation process depends on its size, velocity, and the extent of the plasma charge distribution, etc. However, after the initial current flow begins around the object, what will happen depends more on the potential energy stored in the plasma. Take, for example, an object entering a P region, a positive region, and continuing on towards the N region. By simple collisions with the plasma, it gains a surface charge equal to the charge that would exist in its volume if it were not present. As it moves towards the N region, it creates an extension of the potential in the P region, like a finger. And current from the N direction quickly flows to equalize the local potential. Due to their higher mobility, electrons become the bulk charge carrier by many orders of magnitude. They impinge on the object, quickly charging it to a net negative value. It will maintain a net negative charge for the duration of the relaxation process. Wow. Now, is this essential? Right there is a Nobel Prize winning sentence, that this is the process that causes the comet nucleus or object to become negatively charged and maintain that charge. Very important. This is the crux of the entire issue. Where do the negative charges come from? Sagan couldn't figure it out. All of Sagan and his merry men couldn't figure it out. Of course, they didn't look very hard because they just assumed, because of Chapman physics, that it wasn't there. Okay, so reading on. As the object charges, the Debye shielding length becomes greater. This is the space charge sheath around it, causing a further breakdown of the capacitor, which in turn causes more current to flow, primarily electrons. A cascade effect quickly moves to break down the entire capacitor. the current flowing via the foreign object. So this is very important. This is like I always give the example of the backyard bug killer, in which the bug flies in between the high potential screen and he's flying in towards the light because he's attracted towards the fluorescent light in the middle. But he breaks down the capacitor of the air, and which is the dielectric in the capacitor, breaks that down, and the electrical discharge goes right where the bug is, always where the bug is. Why does the discharge not go someplace else? Because the bug is doing exactly the same thing as the comet is doing, or this object. And reading on, for this reason, the classical treatment of the Debye length, a single time invariant value for a charged object in a uniform plasma, is not appropriate for the non-uniform charge distribution case. What happens is the Debye shielding distance gets distorted, it gets stretched out. And this is what I'm saying about astronomers, space scientists, etc., that talk about the magnetic tail of Earth. It's not a magnetic tail. It's a Debye shielding of the electrical current. Okay, reading on. Furthermore, no matter how small, now this is very important too, no matter how small the object is or what path it takes relative to the N and P regions, or even if it simply is placed uncharged anywhere in the non-uniform region, the same basic result will eventually occur. So it doesn't matter. This is what I'm talking about. How did this object get there? It doesn't matter how you got there or which direction you came in, or if you came in from the side or the top or the ends or wherever, the same effect is going to happen. So it's very important, how did this object get there? What was the history of this object arriving in the plasma? Okay, so reading on, the object will gain a net negative charge due to the higher mobility of electrons. The cascade effect will cause the increased current to flow, which in turn increases the negative charging on the object. This process continues until the entire capacitor is drained or until another process terminates the discharge. And then the basic result of the plasma's tendency to quickly work to a state of the lowest potential, the higher mobility of electrons and the interaction of the object with the plasma. So anyway, then I talk about the backyard bug killer here. I actually use that as an example, as a demonstration. And then just read on a little bit more here. And very important, the concepts. And here's what I'm doing. I'm defining the parameters. So I'll give an example here of the definition of parameters. Figure 2 shows a fully developed discharge between N and P regions. Boundary layer is marked caused by an object M1 shown in the P region, and that's just the way the figure is in the paper. You can see this, like I say, this is an appendix of my Atlantis to Tesla, the Colburn Connection book. X and Y coordinates are included for reference, and the sum of D, the charge distribution, U, electric potential, E, electric fields, B, magnetic fields, and H plus space charge sheath distribution. So that's a hydrogen, an ionized hydrogen space charge sheath distribution is drawn around the comet nucleus. And you can, this object, which potentially could be a comet nucleus. But when you see a comet, a lot of times you see that green bulbous region around the comet nucleus. That's the Debye shielding. You can actually see it. And it's the hydrogen green line that you mainly see it. So it's usually green. It can be other colors if there's other species of atoms. Some people attribute it to carbon, but we know that hydrogen is the primary dominant species out there. And so that green color, and you can see the green color. If you look at pictures of comets, you look at the green Lima line, the green line of the hydrogen spectrum. Good grief. It's the exact same green. Your eyes can see it unless you're colorblind. Okay. Also, reading on here about the figure, note the tributary effect in the far reaches of the discharge as current streamers funnel into the main discharge. And so it's like tributaries on a river that they all feed into this main discharge. And the current is pulled together by the pinch effect. Okay, here we are, 1987. I'm defining that the pinch effect is what's going on here. Now, I've also talked about this in relative to the plasma propulsion systems that I defined, because this is such an important aspect of that, the intergalactic electric currents that flow down the galactic arms. It's so important to understand this, and I used to use examples like a square rig sailing ship, where the square rig sailing ship is sailing across the ocean and puts its sails up, and the wind pushes it across the ocean. What if you could, instead of just having the wind that hits the sail, what if because the boat was there, it acted to concentrate the wind on the sails of the sailboat? Wow, what a benefit. You're concentrating all of this current onto the actual propulsion system itself. And that's an essential thing in understanding how electromagnetic propulsion systems work, the non-inertial type that I invented. And that's when I would go to meetings and present this, these are physicists, tier one physicists, who were working in this field. And they couldn't believe that they had completely missed this. But then again, why would anybody invent a plasma the propulsion system based on a non-inertial design if they didn't know that these effects were occurring out there? I'm the only person that knew this and understand how this actually worked. Okay, so reading on, I'm talking about the pinch effect, and the pinch current is more the rule than the exception. In other words, whenever you get a comet or a moon of Saturn or any of these objects discharging the local non-uniform electric field, there is the pinch effect working, and so that concentrates the charge and augments the discharge and the comet effect. Okay, so M1 has a surface charge, Q, which continues to grow with time. Now, the understanding of surface charge is very important, because when the Rosetta mission got near Comet 67P, they looked and they didn't see anything around the nucleus. There was no water or ice or snow, or there was nothing coming off the nucleus for 10 kilometers around. There was nothing, when it should have looked like this steam locomotive belching gas and dust out. Nothing. Zero. And of course, they still call it a dirty snowball. I mean, these people are brain dead. But the concept of space charge accumulation or surface charge around an object, which is this object coming into the non-uniform plasma, is essential also. Okay, so I'm going to take a little segue here, and I'm going to talk about something that I did. At the time, remember that during this time frame in the mid-1980s, I was gainfully employed as an engineer, a systems engineer, in a telecommunication corporation with emphasis on communication protocols, encryption, and performance, and design of telecommunications equipment. Okay, so at any rate, what I did is I went over to a local high school to do a demonstration for students at the request of a physics teacher. And this was advanced class for maybe at a junior high level or high school. I don't remember all the details. But at any rate, he took a Van de Graaff generator that they had in the laboratory, and I said, here, this is what we're going to do. And when you have a Van de Graaff generator, one of the accessories is this plastic rod with another little metal ball at the end, and you can do various things. And so what I did is I took a wire and I connected the little ball to the big ball of the Van de Graaff generator, and then we charged it up. And what would that do? That would give a net negative charge on the little ball, and the big ball, and they would combine electric fields, etc. And then we took wood splints. And these are done a lot of times in chemistry and high school experiments. They have a wood splint, and that's a way of getting smoke, ionized smoke, basically. And so anyway, we lit the wood splints and then held it up on the outside of the small charged ball. And lo and behold, you could see the Debye shielding occur around the negative ball. And these, when you light the wood splint, the smoke coming off is positively ionized. And that's why, by the way, smoke is very dangerous for your nose's lung and lungs, is because it's highly ionized. It's like a little mini plasma, so to speak. And there's not a lot of free electrons in the air, which is a dielectric, a neutral dielectric. And so it takes a while for that smoke to become, to lose its ionized potential. But at any rate, we held the wood splint out there, and you can see this, a picture of this, on some of my work. I think it's on one of my posters. It's there's a picture of me there as a young person. And so this is something, too, that when you see my historically important videos, things like that, you're going to see me as a much younger person, aging through the decades as we get up to today's date, in which I'm a little bit older than most people. Whenever I'm in a room with people, I'm typically the oldest person there. Very rarely are many people older than me. But anyway, I don't want to date myself too much here. But this was in the mid-1980s, so you would see me as a much younger person. And if you have my materials, you will see that photo. And it's I'm looking at there, and I think the man is also the physics professor is there, and holding the wood splint with the ball of smoke, kind of in a nebulous form around the negatively charged ball. So this is literally the laboratory experiment which high school students can do. And so why the $64,000 million question is, why can't NASA scientists do this? And of course, their only comment is no comment. Anyway, I'll read a little bit more from this paper. Then I'm going to go into the spacecraft that went to Comet Halley and discuss their instrumentation and the poor design of the spacecraft for what they were intended to do, and the some anecdotes about that time period. Okay, so reading on a little bit here, I'm talking about electrons. In the vicinity of the object are the highest density regions of the sheath, talking about the space charge sheath. An influx of plus ions from the sheath slowly settling onto the object, and higher energy plus ions and dust particles, ionized dust particles in the discharge impinging on the negatively charged object from the P direction. And so in the terms of a comet, this would be the anti-sunward direction. That, in other words, the comet tail. This is what I'm describing here. All contribute to the detectable infrared aura around the object, which may extend to visible light depending on the density, fluorescence, reflected light, sunlight, etc. Additionally, now this is the part I wanted you to listen to. Additionally, the electron beam interacts with the ions in the sheath and in falling plus ions, forming an infrared or possibly visible spike extending in the N direction. And remember, in the three-part comet paper, I'm very specific that this would be the region where you would detect X-rays in a comet, a full-blown comet. And in fact, they discovered X-rays in that region. Okay, so the region marked plasma tail, the electron current is pinched into the oppositely moving plus ion and ionized dust current. This can create zones of turbulence with high-energy collisions. If the plasma ion dust tail is visible, the turbulence moving towards the P direction should be readily observable. And this is, you see this in comet tails. You see that turbulence as that thin type 1 tail or the thin type 2 tail goes out. It interacts with the tail of the comet a lot of times, and you see this turbulence. You can actually see it. So anyway, then I go on to talk about the magnetic fields and the magnetic fields that are in the tail region, that are out in front of the comet or this object, etc. And then I break down and I give a drawing essentially right around the object itself, what the electrical currents are like, the magnetic fields, the flow of ions, the flow of dust particles, etc. And that's it. That's it. And so a very important paper, the study of foreign objects as they interact with a non-uniform plasma, something that just really was unheard of at the time, and even today is unheard of. This same paper today would be light years ahead of what anybody else is doing or understanding of plasmas. Just a caveat here, there are plasma engines, and there are useful aspects of plasmas that are being used in industry today, also in jet engines. There's a type of bladeless jet engine that is coming on the scene. It's actually being used. Very interesting technologies. But the plasma jet engines use discharge techniques to create high-energy plasmas that then are used for thrust. So I want to just mention that this, what I'm talking about, is very different. What I'm talking about is free plasma in outer space that is being driven by the solar battery, basically, the fusion battery of the sun. And if you're in the galaxy, it's the fusion battery of the galactic nucleus that's driving the activity. Okay, so on to this flotilla of spacecraft then went out to visit Halley's Comet. And these were all there in March of 1986. So let me just go through these. I've already talked about the Giotto, the French spacecraft that actually took the photos of the sun side of the nucleus and determined that it was the blackest object in the solar system. I won't go through that again. I talked about that last week, the fluffier and fluffiest. I think that was last week or 2 weeks ago. The fairy tale, the grim fairy tale, regarding the discovery that instead of being this white, fluffy snowball, the nucleus of the comet Halley was the blackest object ever detected in the solar system. And then since, they've been to many comets, all of them the same, black, dark, no water, no ice. And scientists are scratching their various body parts trying to figure out how come there's no ice, suggesting that, well, first of all, they said, well, maybe it was in deep fissures. And then after they looked closely, there were no deep fissures. And because they had a camera, like they're orbiting Comet 67P for months and taking pictures, there's no fissures, there's no water coming out. So then they're going, well, maybe it's deeper underground. We'll have to send another comet probe to drill. Well, there's nothing coming out the nucleus, bozos. And this thing should have been dead years and decades ago. But the whole charade of dirty snowball comet model lives on. Okay, so the Russian spacecraft, there was the Vega 1 and the Vega 2. They were fairly simple spacecraft, fairly small, and they had the odd situation that because of the way they got the probes out to Comet Halley, by wrapping them around in low orbit around the planet Venus, they decided to do a study of Venus also. So part of the payload went towards studying Venus, the planet. And then the other part of the payload went on to visit Halley's Comet. And they had a two-space probe approach. They sent the first space probe in close to the comet nucleus with the idea of sampling the tail material, etc., to see how close they should go with the second spacecraft. And so they did not have to adjust the trajectory of the second spacecraft much. They had magnetic field detectors, particle detectors, spectrometers on board, and then it was gyrostabilized, three-axis gyrostabilized, which means like a gyro in an airplane, for example, in the old mechanical airplanes, they would have a three-way gyro, and that would give you a reckoning with the airplane. And with the spacecraft, they do stabilization, so the gyro wheels are big enough that it can maintain, because the gyros are going to keep spinning in the direction they're spinning in. So if the spacecraft gets twisted or distorted or whatever, you can position the craft relative to the gyro stabilization and determine exactly where you want a camera to take a picture, etc. But they really did not return with any usable data from the cameras. They had video cameras on the Vega 1 and Vega 2. Otherwise, they did not have X-ray detectors. They should have, but of course everybody, even the Russians back then, believed that comets were dirty snowballs. There would be no need to have an X-ray detector. I talked about the Jacobini-Zinner ISW3 satellite, which was converted to go out to the comet Jacobini-Zinner, and they turned off the X-ray detector on purpose to save batteries. And when I called up the principal investigators on that, I told them, don't turn off the X-ray detector. You will see X-rays. Oh, no, they didn't listen. And eventually, the X-rays in comets would have been discovered in as early as 1985 with the Jacobini-Zinner flyby, instead of waiting until 1996 when it was fully discovered by accident with the comet Hyakutake, and then comet Hale-Bopp, and then other subsequent comets. Okay, so now the Japanese had a pair of spacecraft, and they did a similar thing, where they went through close with the first spacecraft to give them an idea of how close they could get with the second spacecraft so that they would have a better margin of success, because the last thing you would want is to send your spacecraft out to Comet Halley, you know, the historical comet that's been known about since the Middle Ages and had been seen many times throughout the history, going back to the Chinese years B.C., where it was recorded, where they knew that was Halley's Comet, a regular period comet, the Boyopop tapestry from Middle Ages England, etc. There was a war, there was a battle going on, a famous battle that Halley's Comet appeared, etc. So the Japanese had a pair of spacecraft which really had minimal package also to understand what the mainly they were looking at the composition of the tail material, and once again did not have X-ray detectors, because they went along with the NASA model that, hey, comets are dirty snowballs, there should not be X-rays here. And interestingly enough, NASA squandered an opportunity. They were supposed to work with the European Space Agency. They got into a quibble over funding, who was going to pay more, etc. And the European Space Agency said, hey, we're just going to go this on our own. We don't want to deal with NASA, which I think is interesting, because NASA is supposedly the big money, big power, big theoretical power in everything. And NASA never went to Halley's Comet because of political infighting. Okay, and then we have the Giotto spacecraft. Just go through the instrumentation list on Giotto. But first of all, it's important to understand that Giotto was a gyro-stabilized, a one-axis gyro-stabilized platform. So the spacecraft was spinning 15 times per minute. So once every 4 seconds, the spacecraft would rotate around. And what that did is that maintained the angular momentum, maintained the direction of the Giotto spacecraft. And so what happened was, because some of the instrumentation was specific to direction of where the nucleus was, for example, the camera, it would take a picture every 4 seconds. And they only had a very short window because of the extreme speed that the spacecraft was flying by the nucleus of Halley's Comet. They only had about a half hour. They had, a 4-hour window, but only about a half an hour where they knew that they would be like 300 miles away, just like nose to nose with the comet nucleus. And I'll say this also, when the Giotto spacecraft hit the electron beam in front of the comet nucleus, which my model, the plasma discharge comet model, predicts. It detected that electron beam, a tremendous inrush of electrons. The magnetic fields went off scale. All of the sensors went off scale. And it tumbled out of gyro stabilization. It was about a week or two later where they actually regained contact with the spacecraft and retrieved the data. But they were able to get some pictures, including the famous one where Fred Whipple is there in the control room talking about the white snowball, which then turns out to be the blackest object ever recorded. Okay, so there are 11 scientific packages on the Giotto spacecraft. There's a dust impact system, radio science experiment, which deals with comparing different frequency signals. And then there's the ion mass spectrometer, magnetometer to measure the magnetic fields, the optical probe experiment, which was dealing with the polarization of light coming from the dust and gas from the coma area. There were two plasma experiments mainly dealing with solar wind measurements because they wanted to know how the solar wind interacted with the comet. And then an energetic particle analyzer, then the camera. There's a 16-millimeter Ritchie Chrétien telescope, and 16-centimeter lens on this camera, two CCD chips fixed in red and blue, and clear filters, had a set of filters on the camera. And then another plasma analyzer, neutral mass spectrometer for the neutrals, detecting the neutrals and determining their mass, so mass spectrometer basically, and then a particle impact analyzer. So these are the packages on the Giotto spacecraft as it flew in. And of course, it did not have an X-ray detector, which I keep repeating. You're probably tired of hearing that. Well, I was amazed that nobody would listen, only to have the X-rays discovered in 1996, a full 10 years later. And this all could have happened, but they did not. These spacecraft also were poorly designed for the job intended because they did not understand they were dealing with something that was electrically charged, etc. So they missed all kinds of science opportunities. They flew right through the Dubai Shield. They didn't detect it because they didn't know it was there. They didn't, it's the old expression, if you don't look for it, you're probably not going to see it. Anyway, I'm out of time here, so a good summary of this 1986 time frame, Halley's Comet, the paper, the dealing with foreign objects, discharging non-uniform plasmas, a very rich scientific time, and of course, once again, my work is central to all of this. And, of course, with the fleets of scientists walking around in a cloud, not having any idea what they were doing. This is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And, as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.